Hello, welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the Cult of Matamoros. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive contents, as my friends Channel and Anthony did, as well as the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Sharon, Debbie, Becky, and Matt. They all went to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Alright, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax, and grab yourself a drink. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last episode, we had been discussing Adolfo Costanza and his growing cult in Mexico City, which began around 1983-1984. We know that the very first official member of Adolfo's cult was Omar Ochoa, who was cut into the cult on October 12th, 1983. And according to a journal that Adolfo kept, as well as to Omar himself, not long after this, Costanza began instructing him on the construction of a Nagana. You'll recall, Nagana is the magical cauldron that practitioners of Nyambe use when they are doing their various spells. It contains sticks, various organs from animals, and in some cases, such as the cult of Adolfo Costanza, human beings, including their brains. Now, according to this journal that Costanza kept, there were other initiates into Nyambe who simply disappeared. Specifically, two women who we know very little about. On the fact that her name was Pilar, and that she was with the cult for roughly a year before simply vanishing. Another member of the cult, another female by the name of Maria, who we discussed in the last episode, was also brought in as a high priestess of Mayambe, but she too ends up disappearing after about a year. There's been a lot of speculation as to what became of these two women. One train of thought has it that they may have fallen out of favor with Adolfo and become victims of the cult. The other train of thought is that, again, they'd fallen out with Costanza, but had simply moved away from his influence. Now, many investigators have discounted the idea that these women were murdered by Costanza, pointing to the fact that his known victims were predominantly male. Also, there is testimony from a number of the surviving members of the cult that Maria, or Mara, as some accounts give her name, actually left their group and moved to Guadalajara. However, to the best of my knowledge, no one was able to ever track this woman down. This next piece of information comes from three members of the cult who were there from the beginning, namely Omar, Martin, and Jorge. They stated that after Costanza had been in Mexico City for about a year and had initiated them, helping them to construct their own Nagana, it was time for Adolfo to have one, and that at some point in 1985, the four of them went to a graveyard on the outskirts of Mexico City, where they searched until a grave that was about a year old was discovered, at which point they dug the body up, taking the skull, tibias, toes, ribs, and fingers of the individual inside of the grave. As in Miambi, it's believed that this will give the Nagana of the Palo an almost sentient power, with the skull and brain providing intelligence for the cauldron, but also imbuing it with spirit and the soul of the deceased, who can then be bent to the will of the Palo, in this case, Adolfo Costanza. Now, according to researchers of the cult of Matamoros, the individual whose remains were chosen for this Nagana had to be someone who had died violently. That is, either was murdered, died in a confrontation with others, or by an accident, as it's believed that such a spirit will be so confused by their sudden death and then their sudden return to some semblance of life that they will be more pliable to the Palo's commands and thus willing to commit evil as the Palo directs it to. When they left the grave, Costanza and his three companions are said to have left a headless chicken as well as a small stack of pennies, payment to the spirits for what they had just removed from the graveyard. Omar Letter said that Costanza had been preparing them for this moment for quite a considerable amount of time, instructing them on the prayers and chants that they would need to do on the night that he constructed his Nagana. Returning to one of the apartments, Costanza is said to have removed the remains and placed them before his altar before laying down on the ground, at which point the other three men began reciting the words that Adolfo had told them and placing a white sheet over him and lighting candles. This was to symbolize Adolfo being laid out dead so that he could commune with the spirit of the deceased. After which point, one of the men placed gunpowder on the blade of a knife and held it over a candle. According to those who were present, after a considerable period of time, Costanza's face turned beet red, the veins beneath the skin standing out darkly as his body became rigid, while blood began to pool under his hands as his fists, which were clenched tightly, dug into the soft skin of his palms. Omar Letter said that while the men were somewhat frightened by this, they did not fully fear it, as Adolfo had told them that the spirit of the dead man whose remains they had stolen was going to transfer from the remains and into Costanza himself. According to Omar, he had been prepared for this by Costanza, and that when the possession began to occur, he spoke to the spirit, demanding to know whether or not it was willing to serve El Padrino. After asking this question, Omar says that Costanza began speaking in a voice that was unearthly, not his own, and informed those gathered that it would indeed serve Costanza. After which, everything in the room went deathly still. A few moments after this, the gunpowder which had been placed on the blade of the knife ignited, and this seemed to bring Adolfo back to his senses. The three men who were present later told authorities that they found the entire experience unnerving, as Adolfo stood commanding them to bring forth the cauldron that was to be used as his nagana, and it appeared to them that he was completely unaffected by what had just transpired. They took this as a sign of El Padrino's power. Now, the bones of the individual whose grave they had robbed were placed inside of the cauldron, along with a slew of different items, including a roasted turtle, a boiled cat, a goat's head, deer antlers, insects, coins, a piece of paper with the man's name on it, dirt from his grave, and chicken blood, and numerous other things, including 28 tree branches from carefully chosen trees, were placed inside of the nagana, which now, according to the traditions of Miyambi, had a sentient life force of its own, which would have to be bargained with, placated, tricked, and bribed in order to do the bidding of the Palo Costanza. Or, as he was called during ceremonies during which the nagana was used, Tata Nikisi, which translates to Father of the Spirit. Now, the day after this nagana is constructed, Costanza, with his rodeos, or initiates present, sprayed the nagana with rum and cigar smoke before offering it the blood from a rooster and a hen. Later, as things within the cult become darker, he is going to supplant the blood of these animals with that of his rodeos, taking a small quantity from each of them and offering it to the spirit that dwells inside of the cauldron. Omar later said that after this particular offering of blood, the first time that the nagana had been given such treatment, Adolfo then asked the spirit within the cauldron to protect him and those he deemed as his family, to make them rich and powerful, but also to bring them new believers. Not long after this ceremony took place, Costanza experienced a major upswing in his business that his followers attributed to his power as a Palo, but also to the nagana that he had constructed with their help. And it wasn't just regular run-of-the-mill people and tourists who were coming to seek out Costanza for his magical abilities, but also powerful people, people with a lot of money, such as models who he met through modeling gigs, as well as stars of television and music. All of them began talking about Adolfo, spreading the word of how powerful his magic was, but also of how, for the right price, there was no magic spell that he was not willing to perform. And this willingness brings in a lot of money, which allows Costanza, by early 1985, not long after he had constructed the nagana, to purchase a much nicer condominium, one that took up an entire floor in a very fashionably chic area of Mexico City at this point in time, in an area known as Colonia Roma. We know that in this particular condominium, Adolfo set up what he called the De los Muertos, the Room of the Dead, And that it is this room where he does the darkest of his magic. And that every place moving forward that he and his cult members will occupy will have one of these De Los Muertos, where the Nagana is kept. Know that in 1986, Costanza was introduced to a fairly popular Mexican singer by the name of Oscar Athey, who at this point in time was in something of a lull in his career. He was brought to meet Costanza at a fairly popular restaurant in Mexico City. We know that Costanza promised Oscar that he could give him a complete career resurgence in exchange for $2,000. According to Oscar, he did not have this money and told Costanza as much. And Costanza then said that he would cleanse his spirit for him, which would bring him good luck, free of charge, provided that Oscar introduce him to still more famous and powerful people. After performing this ceremony on Athey, he does in fact experience a career resurgence. When news of everything that Costanzo is going to end up doing comes to light, and Athey's name is brought up in conjunction with the cult, he will swear up and down that he had only gone to Costanzo on a few occasions for spiritual cleansings, that he had no involvement in the cult and knew nothing of the darker aspects of what they were involved with, further stating that Costanza had come to him a number of times after these cleansings, and that he, Athey, had rebuffed Costanza, not wishing to deal with the man further. Whether or not this is true, we cannot say with certainty, but we do know that after experiencing this spell with Costanza, Athey's career took off once more, and in gratitude for what Costanza had done for him, he began spreading word about this strange padrino operating out of Mexico City who could work miracles. And it's through this connection and the subsequent celebrities that end up coming to Costanza that word of his magical prowess eventually reaches the ears of local drug smugglers. We know that some of the spells that Costanza did for many of these individuals included the sacrifices of baby lions, full-grown zebras, small bears, and things of that nature. Now, around this point in time, Costanza makes a new client who quite possibly may end up being one of the most powerful he is ever going to have. And that is a man by the name of Florentina Ventura Gutierrez. Now, Gutierrez had been the head of the Federal Judicial Police, which puts him on par with the head of the FBI in the United States in terms of importance and power within law enforcement circles in Mexico. He was seen as an exceptionally dedicated federale, and also as a man who was no nonsense. Now, if his name is familiar to you, it's most likely because he was involved in discovering the individuals responsible for murdering a DEA agent in Texas by the name of Enrique Kiki Camarena, who had been murdered by drug smugglers for sticking his nose into their business. When exactly Ventura became acquainted with Costanza is unknown to me, although it was at some point in 1985. By this point, Ventura had left the Federales and had been appointed as the Mexican head of the international police agency known as Interpol. It later emerged that Ventura was an extremely superstitious individual who sought out practitioners of various religious magics in order to protect himself from his enemies, both on the side of law as well as on the opposite side in the drug world. We know with certainty that Ventura paid Costanza thousands of dollars, and investigators later came to believe, after all of the things that Costanza became involved with, that Ventura may in fact have paid Costanza off with much more than money. He may in fact have been funneling information to Costanza which was beneficial to both Adolfo as well as his burgeoning list of drug smugglers and cartel members. We do know that the relationship between Costanza and Ventura was such that on certain occasions when meeting with an exceptionally powerful new client, Costanza would introduce himself as Alejandro de Jesus Ventura, representing himself not only as a Palo, but also as Ventura's nephew. While we will likely never know with certainty whether or not Ventura was giving Costanza inside information, we do know with absolute certainty that as early as summer of 1985, one of Ventura's staunchest allies, by the name of Salvador Vidal Garcia Alarcon. Now, Salvador was a sub-commandant with the Federales when he met Costanza, and there is evidence that he was in fact giving information to Costanza, which Costanza was then able to use in order to protect his clientele in the drug smuggling world, letting them know times that it would behoove them to make a drug shipment and, you know, where they should do it at, as well as letting them know times and places where a shipment should not be sent through. Vidal is going to become a ardent follower of Costanza, and is eventually going to be reassigned to the small city of Matamoros, which is across the Rio Grande River from Brownsville, Texas, where the most notorious of Costanza's crimes is going to take place. We know that when they met, Salvador was at a crossroads in his life. Previously, he had been injured by a criminal who cut him down the face with a knife and scarred him deeply, leaving Salvador to believe that he was possessed by three different spirits, each of whom would inhabit his body at different types, that he was led to Adolfo by one of Costanza's followers in the hopes that Adolfo could cleanse the man's spirit and rid him of these demonic entities. And Salvador is going to end up being brought into the fold as a Polero, a devotee of Mayambe, becoming one of Costanza's most devoted followers. According to members of the cult, Salvador quickly found that these spirits which had been possessing him were no longer there, that he was in control of his own mind, will, and actions once again. And in exchange for this, Costanza pledged him to a god of Santeria called Siete Reyes, who was the harbinger of swift and violent death. Costanza then charged Salvador with being the group's enforcer, who would be sent out to exact revenge whenever Siete Reyes was offended. And it's through Salvador that Costanza, already with a quite impressive list of clientele, which included drug smugglers, moves into the higher echelon of drug trafficking, many of whom came from backwater towns and villages spread throughout Mexico that had very great superstitious beliefs, which, once introduced to Costanza, Adolfo was able to play off on to gain their trust as well as their money. Later, it would emerge at trial that oftentimes during this point, Costanza would perform a ritual for one of the traffickers and immediately afterwards contact Salvador to let him know what was going on, and that Salvador would ensure that the correct officials were paid off and that routes for the smugglers were clear of government interference. Now, through all of these machinations, Costanza is going to become fairly well off, earning anywhere from $10,000 to $40,000 a spell from the drug traffickers. However, as he sees these traffickers reaping in massive amounts of money, Costanza's greed begins to get the better of him, and he decides that he no longer wants to just be a practitioner of Mayombe. He, in fact, wants to partner up with one of these criminal organizations so that he, too, can earn the type of money that they are. And it's actually this that is going to lead to Costanza and his followers becoming the serial killers that the world would know them as when things end up falling apart. We know that through Salvador Vidal, Costanza was introduced to the Calzada drug family, known primarily for smuggling cocaine out of Mexico and Central America and into the United States, but also for owning a number of businesses in and around Mexico City. During this point in time in the Mexican drug trade, cocaine came up through South America into Mexico. Most of it was brought to the border towns. However, some of it was brought to Mexico City, where organizations like the Calzada family would load it up inside of various packages and get it across the border. It was a fairly lucrative, albeit extremely dangerous, business to be involved in. Although, from what I could find, these organizations were not like the cartels that are in operation today, who were getting their own drugs and shipping them up into North America. They were little more than carrier pigeons. We know that Garcia introduced Adolfo to the head of the family, Guillermo Arturo Calzada Sanchez, at some point in September of 1986 at the Calzada front company known as FM and Associates, which was ostensibly a muffler shop. We know that through Vidal, Costanza learned pretty much everything that the police knew about the family. And despite the fact that some within the cult looked down on the fact that Costanza used this information to make it appear as though he was a mystic and knew all of these things by throwing the shells, etc., With this information, Costanza was able to impress the family enough that they agreed to trust him. And eventually, this is going to lead the Calzada family to paying Costanza to do limpias, which are basically spells or prayers, to ensure successful smuggling operations. They begin to listen to what Costanza tells them, never dreaming that this Polero was getting his information directly from the police via Vidal, who would let Costanza know when the police were planning on hitting one of the family's shipments or raiding a particular building or business that they operated out of. We know that during this period of time, Costanza was earning roughly $5,000 a month just from Calzada family, and that he was picking the family's collective brain in order that he himself could learn to be a drug smuggler. As his surviving followers later said, after a period of time, Costanza began to grow restless, feeling that the family wasn't paying him enough money for his services. And he began talking about a desire to be a full-fledged partner with the Calzada family. Eventually, Adolfo is going to go to the Calzada family and demand that they make him a full-fledged partner, splitting half of their proceeds with him, which the family roundly rejects. This eventually leads to Costanza being thrown out of the patriarch's home with instructions never to return. We know that as he was leaving the compound, the bodyguards laughed at Costanza for his perceived impudence, and that this further enraged Costanza. We know that Costanza, who had a fairly difficult upbringing, to say the least, had been very careful in constructing a new life for himself in Mexico City, that of the successful, unstoppable Polero. Some researchers believe that what the Calzada family did in basically humiliating Costanza threatened to shatter this mask of unreality that he had created for himself. Now, this is not uncommon with serial killers, where they have come from a background filled with many humiliations, and upon reaching adulthood and having created this powerful fantasy of themselves that they can live with, they can and will react violently to situations that give them embarrassment and remind them of what it was, the trauma that they had experienced in the past. This is one of those numerous stressors that serial killers, particularly budding serial killers, experience prior to the first act of murder. That's not to say that Costanza had not already been working his way up to committing the act of murder. We know from statements that his followers later gave, in the months prior to this confrontation with the family, Costanza had been growing more and more sadistic in his interactions with people who decided that they no longer wanted to participate in his magic, patronize him, give him money. There are stories in court documents of Costanza torturing such individuals inside of his death room, cutting them with his knife in an effort to show them the folly of their ways. One follower later said, quote, "He changed. I became afraid, but I didn't dare leave him." We know that Costanza contacted FM and Associates a few days after this argument took place, and that the gist of the conversation that took place was that Costanza told the head of the family that he had basically been under the spell of an evil spirit, and that he was completely apologetic. He had no idea what came over him, and that he believed that the evil spirit which had inhabited his body may in fact have been intended for the family. Costanza informed Guillermo Calzada that he wanted to do a very specific spell just for them to ward off these evil spirits, and that this spell would be free of charge. Guillermo agreed to this. So the stage is set for a ceremony to take place at Guillermo's office building slash home on April 30th of 1987. Costanza informs Guillermo that the entire family must come to this ceremony if it is going to be successful. Once there, he sets about preparing for this special ceremony, which everyone present believed was a cleansing ceremony. And he told all of those gathered that they would have to participate in the actual practice of magic. It's hard to know exactly what happened at this ceremony. There are some reports from those who were actually present at it. However, these have to be taken with a grain of salt as not completely being reliable. We know that Costanza began his ceremony with magic candles being lit and began to go through the motions. And from reports that we have, at some point, his followers burst into the room with machine guns drawn as Costanza pointed at each of those individuals who was gathered at the ceremony, calling each of them in turn an enemy. The following day, May 1st of 1987, the husband of one of those who participated in this ceremony, Celia Campos Decline, contacted authorities to inform them that his wife had gone to this ceremony at her employer's home/office building and had not returned. He informed the officers that he himself had been meant to attend, however, he had not been able to go as his own job needed him at the last minute. So officers are dispatched to Calzara's home, where they find a crowd gathering. A Volkswagen microbus is parked in front of the building and has been completely gutted by fire. Officers enter the building and immediately sense that something is wrong. There's broken eggshells all over the place, shattered statues of Christian saints, pock marks in the walls, and as they explore further, they find a pool of drying blood at the foot of a staircase. Officers are unable to find any bodies inside of the building, nor are any of the individuals who are thought to be responsible for having committed this crime present. In fact, there's very little evidence whatsoever to point officers in the direction of what actually has taken place here beyond the wreckage inside of the living room and the pool of blood. They don't even know the name or names of the individuals who were supposed to have been performing this religious ceremony. Their attention is diverted, however, when they discover evidence that drug smuggling had been taking place inside of the building. Very quickly, officers decide that what they are dealing with is, in fact, a drug murder, and that the individuals who had been inside of the building obviously had been killed either by a rival gang or by individuals that they had been in business with. After going over further evidence in the house, it's estimated that whoever committed this crime left with somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000 USD. Eventually, police are going to learn that Calzada, his wife, mother, a teenage maid, his bodyguard, who's called El Titi, as well as Calzada's business partner, Jose de Jesus Gonzalez Rolan, and the secretary, Cecilia Decline, are all missing. They are able to match all of these individuals up to missing persons report that begin to filter in over the next few days. Police were so certain that this had been a drug hit, they began entertaining the possibility that a Colombian hit team had actually descended on FM and Associates to liquidate the Calzada family and all of their associates. Now, on May 7th of 1987, two bodies were discovered in the Rio Zampango River, which is north of Mexico City. The bodies were discovered on the banks of the river, which at this point in time was pretty well filled with trash. The victims were nude, bound hand and foot, and severely mutilated. Investigators discovered that one of the victims, a male, had had the right index finger cut off and a $20 bill stuffed inside of it. The toes were also missing from this body, as were the ears. The victim had been shot, bludgeoned, stabbed, as well as castrated, while the other body, that of a female, was found to have had the throat slit to the extent that only a few pieces of sinew kept the head attached to the cadaver. It was also discovered that the female had had her heart removed. Now, because of a prosthesis that had been implanted in one of the women's breasts, police were able to identify her as 39-year-old Celia Campos Decline, the secretary at FM Associates. Eventually, the male victim was discovered to be El Titi, who is one of the bodyguards that had laughed at Costanza when he had initially made his demand to be made a full partner of the operation. Over the ensuing week, five more bodies were discovered, although not all of them were discovered in the Zampaga River. Some were found in the Tula River, while at least one was found in the Grand Canal that flows through the center of Mexico City. As with the initial two victims, all five bodies were bound and showed signs of extreme torture and mutilation. Two of the victims were found to have had their brains removed, while one victim was discovered to be missing parts of its vertebrae. If you've been listening to this series, you already know that all of these missing body parts are key components to a Pallero's Nagana. Specifically, the brains, which, as discussed earlier, are a way to give the Nagana a sentient being that can then be bent to the will of the Pallero. Now, unfortunately, only one of the bodies was eventually able to be identified, and this was the 17-year-old maid of the Calzada family, Gabriela Mondragon Vargas. Obviously, the police believed that the remaining victims were those individuals who had gone missing on the night of April 30th. After these discoveries, the police continued to operate under the assumption that the victims had fallen afoul of Colombian drug dealers and that a hit team had been sent up from South America to deal with them. However, it is known that due to the ritualistic nature of these crimes, the police did in fact tangentially investigate the idea that witchcraft and black magic might have been involved, speaking to a number of brujos in the area as well as a few paleros. The police end up conferring with the DEA in the United States, trying to get a bead on any information that might lead to the identities of those responsible for these crimes. However, the DEA was unable to give them any information, and eventually the cases go cold. One aspect of this case that individuals often overlook is the fact that prior to these killings, Costanza and the other members of his cult had made significant inroads into the drug trafficking market. It's known that Costanza, through various members of his cult, as well as through some of his clients, had come into contact with drug lords operating out of South America. And that because of this, Costanza was able to live a rather extravagant lifestyle. By the point of these killings in 1987, it's known that Costanza owned at least 10 different properties throughout Mexico City, as well as numerous high-priced cars. And this opulence is only going to continue, as now with the family that Costanza was serving out of the way, he is able to move further into the drug trafficking world. As for the killings themselves, the surviving members of his cults later told authorities that during the act of murder, Costanza had seemed to relish in each new indignity that was inflicted upon one of the victims, as he had in fact carried out each act of brutality himself, while the others simply stood there. We do know that some of his more ardent followers at this time participated, albeit hesitantly, in some of the acts of barbarism, but that it was Costanza himself who did the majority of the mutilation and murder, just as we know that Adolfo seemed to achieve a level of almost orgasmic ecstasy as the butchery and killing grew more and more frenzied. We know that some of his followers had been disgusted by what had taken place, but such was their bond to Costanza that they were unable to break free, and those who had shown the weakest stomach for what had occurred, such as his bodyguard Martin, were punished after the fact, as Costanza made them bring the grisly trophies that had been taken from the victims back to his death room, where they were ceremoniously placed inside of the Nagana. We know that on the day after the killings, Costanza admitted to those who had not been present when he had committed the acts of murder, in gory detail, what had occurred the previous night. One follower, Omar, later told police that Costanza justified his actions and their future actions by telling his followers, quote, "Think of it that way. Human sacrifice is not murder. Their spirits have not died. They exist now to serve us. Do it. Kill, and then your souls will be truly dead, like mine, and you will have no fear, no weakness left in you, just power." Now, after having committed these murders, the cult continued on with its normal activities as though nothing had happened. Costanza still performed his various rituals for paying customers, as well as operated on the fringes of the drug smuggling world. We know that in June of 1987, a new, more lucrative avenue was opened for the cult as Salvador Vidal, the member of the Federales, was given a promotion and transferred from Mexico City to Matamoros, where Vidal would end up working directly beneath Comandante Guillermo Perez, who was known by many to be in the pockets of the various criminal organizations operating throughout Mexico. Obviously, this is going to give Costanza and his crew an opportunity to further expand their criminal enterprises, but also to earn a lot more money, which to Costanza equals power and is the sole basis for the crimes that he is going to commit in the future. We are going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you have enjoyed our second look at the cult of Matamoros, and we will be back next week with the third episode. Until next time, stay morbid.